The other reading is 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 8. This is on page 1219. 1 Peter 3, 8. Finally, all of you, live in harmony with one another. Be sympathetic, love as brothers. Be compassionate and humble. Do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult, but with blessing, because to this you were called, so that you may inherit a blessing. For whoever would love life and see good days must keep his tongue from evil and his lips from deceitful speech. He must turn from evil and do good. He must seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are attentive to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Who is going to harm you if you are eager to do good? But even if you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. Do not fear what they fear. Do not be frightened.
Please do be seated. That was a lovely time of prayer that we had just now from the mains, and they prayed for me, so I'm not going to pray again and ask you to turn to Psalm 34. There's a lovely 17th century hymn by Tait and Brady, which goes like this, and many of you will recognize it. Oh, make but trial of his love, experience will decide, how blessed are they, and only they, who in his truth confide. Oh, make but trial of his love, experience will decide. And that hymn is taken, of course, from Psalm 34 and verse 8, which is our text this morning, and I'll read it again. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. And you'll notice immediately from the language that is used in the beginning of verse 8 that this is an appeal to experience. Surely in your family, at some time, eating a meal or an ice cream, one of you has said to the other, taste. And we pass it on to somebody else, perhaps rather unhygienically. We offer a sample from our plate to somebody else who takes a fork and tastes it. And smacking their lips, they say, delicious. Or perhaps less elegantly, yum yum. So what he's doing in verse 8 is to appeal to the reality of Christian experience. And that's going to be our theme this morning. When I prepared this, of course, I'd not heard the rather devastating exposure on the radio this morning, if you listened to that program early on Sunday morning, of some of the fantastic experiences being offered in London churches today. Though all that I have to say, though I shan't change it in the light of that, has a great deal to say to that. Because there are weird and fantastic experiences which are being given the name of Christian today, we shouldn't fly from Christian experience. It is a very, very important thing indeed to taste that the Lord is good and gracious. And this tasting, this experience, begins, of course, at conversion, whatever you like to call it, that time when Christian things become for us firsthand. We turn from darkness to light. We're born again. We're regenerated. We're renewed by the Holy Spirit. And what is interesting to me is that Peter seems to have meditated very greatly on this psalm. And so once or twice I shall turn you to 1 Peter to see what he has to say about it, because it will help me know what I ought to say about it. So keep your fingers, if you will, very firmly in Psalm 34. We're going to have to work hard to look at a great deal of this psalm this morning, but at the same time, occasionally glance over to 1 Peter, and here to 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 3. And here there is a direct allusion to verse 8 of Psalm 34. He's here urging the new Christians to crave the milk of the Word. Verse 2, you know this verse so well. 1 Peter 2:2, like newborn babies, crave pure spiritual milk, so that by it you may grow up in your salvation. That is, develop an appetite for the things of God. And why do you want to develop that appetite? Well, you've already had an experience of His goodness. Verse 3, now that you have tasted that the Lord is good. So Peter is writing to Christians. He's writing to Christians who've tasted something of the Lord's goodness and need now to continue with an appetite for more Christian experience. Now, obviously, Christianity is more than experience, but it is not less. To use the language of cliché, there is head knowledge and heart knowledge, which ought to be two sides of the same coin for all of us. It's about heart knowledge that I'm going to be speaking this morning from this psalm, because the psalm is all about it, and I'm going to be guided by what David has to say. I've only two things. We may have time only for the first, but it's an important thing, I think, to say about this psalm, and here it is. The first thing that Psalm 34 makes abundantly plain about Christian experience is that it is not a naive experience. Or to put it more positively, it is thoroughly realistic. What we're going to discover about this psalm is that it's got its feet on the ground. Let me read to you, I haven't got any more quotations, this is my only one, but I've been following Peter Craigie's little commentary. It's not an unprofitable commentary on the Psalms. And as a summary to all that he has to say about Psalm 34, he says this, which I think puts it very well. The fear of the Lord is indeed the foundation of life, the key to joy in life and long and happy days. But it is not a guarantee that life will always be easy, devoid of the difficulties that may seem to mar so much of human existence. It may mend the broken heart, but it does not prevent the heart from being broken. It may restore the spiritually crushed, but it does not crush the forces that may create oppression. The psalm, if fully grasped, dispels the naivety of that faith which does not contain within it the strength to stand against the onslaught of evil. Now again, I had no knowledge this morning that Elizabeth was going to take so many examples of crushing sorrows and difficulties, those that we prayed about this morning. But they're part of life, aren't they? It isn't just one Sunday in the year that we hear about these things. What are we to say to them? Have we got a tough enough, realistic enough, deep enough experience? Does God give it to survive the rather grim and terrible things that we've already heard about this morning and prayed about? Well, I could mention many, but I'm going to mention three difficulties that emerge in this psalm and which Christian experience can overcome. First, troubles. And they come to all of us because man is born for trouble as the sparks fly upwards. Look at verse 6. This poor man called, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. Verse 17. He delivers them from all their troubles. Verse 19. A righteous man may have many troubles, you see. He's not saying there will be no troubles, that God will wave a wand and the troubles will disappear. The deliverance takes us through the troubles, but does not take us out of them. This word delivers is a very striking one in the psalm. It comes a number of times. Will you follow as I just point them out? I think it's sometimes nice to take an overview of a psalm like this and not just concentrate on one verse. Look at verse 4. He delivered me from my fears. There must be people in church this morning who have deep and proper fears. They're not wrong. We're not without them. We're not magical men who suffer not at all, you know, the doctrine of Christian Science that makes people who follow it so hard. We're not like that. We're human beings. We have fears. Look at verse 6. This poor man called, and the Lord heard him and saved him, delivered him. Look at verse 7. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. Do you remember Elisha telling God, asking God to open the young man's eyes so that he could see that despite all the enemy around him, so threatening, yet God was there protecting. Look at verse 17. He cries out and is delivered. Look at verse 19 again. The Lord delivers him from them all. Not by magically relieving us from pains and perplexities, but bringing us wonderfully through them. Now, we've been thinking this morning about a crushing bereavement for that family. It must be a grim thing for that husband and the parents and so on. But what is the experience that God gives in such times? Well, look at verse 18. I just lost it. The righteous cry out, and surely that must have happened in that family. The Lord hears them. The Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those. Now, isn't that a beautiful word? See, if you wanted to describe an experience that was really true and right and wholesome, it is surely God coming close to us. And many Christians can testify that it's at times like that, when they're brokenhearted, that the Lord comes close. That's the meaning of that promise. That's the reality of Christian experience. There seems to be an even worse experience in verse 20. It's a puzzling verse, isn't it? And John takes it up in his gospel when he refers to the fact that at the crucifixion, the bones of Jesus were not broken. That's a mysterious allusion, isn't it? Again, it shows that God doesn't remove trouble and even suffering of the very worst kind, because he allowed his only begotten son to go through the cross and the Garden of Gethsemane. And yet, it tells us that in that terrible time, certain things were being protected, certain promises were being kept. Now, of course, we can't always say what God is going to do. There are mysteries in the way that God acts, but there's no mystery at the receiving end. All Christians can testify that in these times of agony, God is close. They are the very times which they look back to strangely and say, I would never have been without that experience. Now, what does this mean? It means that far from our experiences of God's grace and kindness coming in the good times, the days when the sun is shining, they come in the grim times and the bad days. Isn't that striking? It's fairly easy, isn't it, to be full of the joy of the Lord, like yesterday when the sun was shining, and very difficult to be full of the joy of the Lord when the frost comes and blights all your new plantings in your garden and so on. We are creatures of physical reality, aren't we? We feel these things. It's hard to rejoice when things go against us. But what is said here is, these may be the very times when God is close. Seems to me that what was being dealt with this morning on the radio, this lusting after the sensational, this lusting after hysterical feelings, is thoroughly cheap and unsatisfying compared with verse 17 and verse 18. And how short-lived they are. I would dare to make a prophecy that this time next year you won't hear the phrase Toronto blessing at all. Already it's fading away. The extraordinary experiences, well, they don't last, and they certainly don't stand with me in the time when I'm crushed in spirit. It's very interesting this morning listening to one or two of these people, and I'll come back to that, how, in a sense, self-centered these experiences are. I felt peace. My racking cough had gone. Now, dear friend, I don't mean to say that if you have a racking cough, that God is not concerned with it, but let's get a sense of proportion. We weren't praying this morning with people with racking coughs, and I'm very thankful. We were praying for people who'd lost children in a car accident. What matters in life? The promises of God are serious promises about serious needs. But it's not only in times of trouble. It's not just the miserable times when God draws near and makes known to us and displays special tokens of love that are very precious to those who receive them. Also, here's another example. It's when we have to live in an increasingly violent, greedy, corrupt and evil society, which is where we seem to be going, and where, of course, many other people suffer far more than we do, as you will know if you've seen the pictures and descriptions of Bosnia even now. How grim it must be to live in Sarajevo at the moment. Now, the 20th century has been a century of illusions. We have believed and been taught that a quasi-utopia can be achieved, that the dreams of men for a fair and just society can be discovered by our own strength and efforts, that evil men and evil things like war and famine can be eliminated. And we're learning at the end of the 20th century that these are illusions. We are coming up against a much greater reality today, and I'm thankful for that. Jesus evidently was under no such illusions. There is no evidence in the Gospels of Jesus pathetically calling for world peace, like Christian leaders do at Christmas in our world. He knew what was in man. But he does give strength, serenity, and assurance to live in that world, and an assurance that this evil will not have the last word. Let's look at two examples. Look at 15 and 16. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are attentive to their cry. It's a lovely thought, isn't it? God's eyes upon us and his ears open, really concerned for us. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to cut off the memory of them from the earth. Now, some of us on Sunday nights in these last 4 weeks have been looking at the severity of God, the reality of hell. You know, here is a psalm full of God's loving kindness, and yet you suddenly meet in verse 16 the intolerable severity, as C.S. Lewis calls it, of the real God. It's not simply that they will be cut off, the memory of them will be cut off. There will be nothing remaining. No one will know anything about them at all in eternity. Their memory will be cut off. It's a striking way of saying, isn't it, that God erases them from history. Look at 21 and 22. Evil will slay the wicked. It'll boomerang on them. The foes of the righteous will be condemned, but the Lord redeems his servants, and no one will be condemned who takes refuge in him. So, the Bible is clear that evil and evil men will continue wretchedly to plague us, and it may be we have worse things to experience in our society in the days ahead. But they have no ultimate future, and we have this assurance that God's face is against them. Now, you see, that's the peace we need. Falling on the floor and having a wonderful sense of peace has got nothing to do with this, has it? This is a peace that deals with a situation when burglary and accidents and violence and corruption are all around us. That is a serenity worth having. So, there are troubles that are realistically faced in this psalm. There's evil, which is realistically faced in this psalm. But I want you to notice another thing that is realistically faced, and that is want. He deals with this matter of want when he talks about the lions. I've just lost them. Where are they? There they are in verse 10. Those who fear the Lord lack nothing. Now that assumes that we live in a world where we will want, where there are risks. Again, we have been living in a fool's paradise, haven't we, in the 20th century. We've been told by Roosevelt in the States that there's going to be freedom from want. We've been told by our own politicians that it's possible to produce a society where no one will want, and of course that is not true. Once again, we find ourselves in a much more real situation where risk is a normal thing in life. Why is it that people complain that the feel-good factor is so elusive in our society today? I suggest to you that because there's been a real sea change. Our jobs are no longer secure. Our money is no longer secure. Our pensions are no longer secure. The employers can no longer give us that kind of security. The old Bank of England used to do that. Japanese firms were said to be specialists in that. No longer. The government can no longer give it. The welfare state can no longer guarantee it. The resources are just not there, nor can the church. The church has discovered it too cannot give security. Missionary societies are ailing. Small churches are faced with closing. Christian charities are struggling to survive. We're living in a society of much greater risk in the 90s than we were earlier on. And everybody is conscious of it. Conscious of it for themselves and their old age and for their children who come after them. What is it that we'll have 4, 5, or 6 different jobs if we are a young 20-year-old today in the course of life? It seems incredible, doesn't it? What insecurity. I've got to have an experience from God that can bring me through that. And that's the meaning, surely, of verse 9 and 10. It's not a blank check. It doesn't mean that money falls from heaven. But it does mean that God is committed to his people. The lions may grow weak and hungry, and they're the very last animals in the in the jungle and on the Kenya plain, aren't they, to grow weak and hungry, as some of you will know, have seen them. But they usually can find their food. Those who seek the Lord lack no good thing. But that's a grand assurance, isn't it? We shall come to positions where we seem to lack, whether we're young or old. But the Lord is with us to give us an assurance that in that society where there is risk and lack and want, he will be concerned for his people. Now, my friends, this is the experience that David is talking about. Why he went through difficulties, didn't he? I don't know whether the title at the beginning of the psalm really does belong to the psalm. It's very difficult to say. But it tells of a particularly painful time in David's life. Here's the king having to pretend to be insane to save his own life. He certainly went through deep waters, didn't he? Not least with his own children. But the experience here is a real one. The Psalms are full of a genuine, deep experience that can survive living among troubles, living in evil surroundings, and living in anxious days. Have you got that experience? Of course, it may be that you've never tasted that the Lord is gracious. But if you have tasted that, are you growing in that experience? Is it yours today? Now, of course, the question is often raised, isn't it, by our more secular friends and our more cynical friends, that this is just escapism. Is this just escapism? Do we come on Sunday night to shut the doors, to gather together, to sing hymns, to rejoice together, and then know very well that this is just an hour and a half when we escape and we go back to real life afterwards? Now, in a sense, Christian experience is an experience of escapism, as long as we define it properly. We escape as God commands us to do, and he does it twice in this psalm, and we look simply at the last verse. We take refuge in him. That is what we're called upon to do. We're not to take refuge from the world. We're to take refuge in him. Then we can live in a world that is fallen and in rebellion against him. So to that extent, we do take refuge. We'll be fools not to. I see that certain prominent theologians and leaders are telling us that the quiet time is obsolete. I hope that's not so for you. I was brought up to treasure the quiet time, and I'm grateful for my spiritual elders and betters who drummed it into my thick head that I would not enjoy the Christian life or grow in grace without some time with God each day. Now, of course there are occasions in life where it is next door to impossible to have a set time every day. The houseman doing their 185 hours a week or whatever it is. The mother with two squalling children to look after on her lap. Who wake up at 3 in the morning or whatever it is and make life very difficult. So there are moments when regular times will be more difficult, but really we all know those are exceptions, don't we? Must we be conned into supposing that in this busy world we can't find time to read and pray? If you are conned into that, no wonder your experience is thin and superficial and can't take you through these hard, dark days that do come to all of us. I take it that taking refuge in God, well, the quiet time is a wonderful example of it, of finding time in quiet, as Jesus says, with the door shut from the noise of the world, the radio, the television, the family, the dog, etc., etc. That's something worth seeking, isn't it? Even if I have to go outside to a public library or whatever it is to find it. Verse 17 pinpoints the proper escape of the Christian. Look at it, verse 17. The righteous cry out. What is that but a momentary quiet time when in the middle of my difficulties I cry out? And again that comes in the Psalms. Verse 5, those who look to him. Verse 6, this poor man called. Verse 15, his ears are attentive to their cry. Verse 17, the righteous cry out. Do you cry out? Do you look to him? Well, if you don't find some time to do this on a more or less regular basis, you will find the day whisks by, your head hits the pillow, and you've spent no time with God. No wonder the world gets on top of us. Don't let's be put down by our secular and cynical friends. Everybody's trying to escape. It is just ludicrous to say that the Christians are escapists when the whole world around us is trying to escape. What is the meaning of the drug scene except a giant exercise in escapism? Young people who can't face the world, who haven't been given the wherewithal to live in this difficult world. What is the meaning of the Barclay brothers building this palace on an island they call themselves, isn't it, off Guernsey or something? What is that except a giant exercise in escape? No one may see them or interview them. They live facelessly, I gather, in Monaco. I wouldn't actually want to escape there, would you? Drama. Or different tastes, different people. Why is it the kids run away from home in such enormous numbers to the immense difficulty of the police in London? What is the lottery? But what a dear lady said only this week, it gives me 2 hours of hope a week. Well, I suppose it's worth a pound to have 2 hours of hope if you've got no other cause for hope. What is the meaning of the mania for this incredibly loud music? I think some of these young people will be deaf by the time they're 40, won't they? I went to a service in Borstal not long ago. I was taken there by some Christian people. I had to sit at the back because the music was so loud it was intolerable. It virtually drove you out of the little chapel where these kids were having their service. You couldn't hear yourself think. But of course that was the point. Because nobody wants to think. If you do think, life's too awful. What's the meaning of this religious fanaticism? It's escapism again, isn't it? We're not escaping into experience, we're escaping into God. And He gives us such experiences of His grace as our troubles and our problems and our situation needs. Don't escape into experience. Take refuge in God, your Heavenly Father. Let me illustrate it as I try to summarize this first point. You read, don't you, quite often of some youth group that has been climbing in the Cairngorms, this sort of time of the year when the spring is coming and the weather is better, and then suddenly the whole weather changes. And you read that this youth group is up in the Cairngorms, and the weather is plunged to -5 degrees, and the snow is coming down, and the fog, and everything is exceedingly dangerous, and they are up there in T-shirts and gym shoes. And the rescue services are really concerned about the risk of hypothermia. Will they be able to survive a night alone, dressed quite inadequately? They went out to have a lovely walk up in the Cairngorms, but they weren't prepared for it. They weren't properly clothed. Now, what I want to say to you is, if you want to live the Christian life, especially if you want to engage in Christian work, and I can see many of you, as I look down there, look from this pulpit, who are engaged in helping others. Well, my friend, that will double your burdens. If you are really going to do Christian work, if you're going to be a Christian person in the real world, you have not only to bear your own burdens, but to bear the burdens of others. So you've got to be properly clothed for the weather. If you're going to venture into this troublesome world and bear some of its burdens, you won't be able to do it without a living experience of Jesus Christ. You'll need a proper equipment. You'll need to taste daily that the Lord is gracious. So first of all, this is not a naive experience. This has its feet on the ground. This is real. This poor man called to the Lord, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles. My second negative, and I'll just have time briefly to note this, I won't expand it at any great length, but I think it's a very important truth, especially in view of what we heard this morning. This heart experience, which is here in the Psalms, and is in Psalm 34, is not a selfish experience. Now, we're living in a time of selfism. I'm not sure if selfism is yet in the dictionary, but it's used a great deal, I think, by writers today, and rightly, for the atmosphere of self-indulgence, of narcissism, of looking in the mirror, of being wrapped up in our own problems, that is so characteristic of today. The testimonies we heard this morning that were under examination were all testimonies of people engulfed in themselves. All people trying to find for themselves the key to life without regard to anybody else. Such as the rather sad story I heard this week of one of the wives of an Oak Hill theological student at Oak Hill Theological College who told her husband that she didn't want to be married to a minister, and he came in tears to a friend of his at college only a week or two ago. What she was really saying to him is, you do your thing, I want to do mine. It's quite a devastating thing to hear if you're a theological student from your wife, don't you think? You've either got to pull out of the work, or persuade her that this is her work as well. Now, this selfishness is, of course, natural to every one of us, basically. I used to think that it was a mark of formalism in religion. I always remember the 8 a.m. communion service at Seven Oaks Parish Church, where I was first ordained, and it was at the 8 o'clock service that the formal religionists used to come. They were people who didn't want to have anything to do with a live church. They used to march in, take the communion, and march out again, looking neither to right or left. It was an extraordinary experience, really, to see it. As though this was entirely something which I did on my own, and no one should trouble me, and I've got to get back to breakfast anyhow, thank you. Well, we all know that kind of formalism. I think it's really disappearing because it bears no fruit. I think the selfishness of fanaticism is far, far more disturbing. Let me warn you against those who tell you that this is the age of the Spirit, which is increasingly the motto of many of these churches. Yes, the whole New Testament age is the age of the Spirit, but if you separate the Spirit, or if the Spirit is separated in your thinking from the Bible and the historic Christ, the Spirit becomes the Spirit of the age. And the Spirit of the age, my friends, is the Spirit of the New Age. What we're seeing in many of these fantastical experiences is not the Spirit of God, but the Spirit of the New Age. It is everywhere. If you don't think it is everywhere, go to the most distinguished bookshop in Piccadilly, Hatchard's, and you will find there that they have a whole section on the New Age. They know what they're selling to. That's the spirit of today. That's where they can sell books. Perhaps also it's because we live in a time when community is breaking down that so many people are living in isolation and loneliness. Now, what are we to say to that? Well, I think Psalm 34 is helpful. The first thing to say positively is that the experience of Psalm 34 is a personal one. We're not dismissing that. It is not simply a community experience. Look at the first verses. I will extol the Lord at all times. His praise will always be on my lips. My soul will praise the Lord. Let the afflicted hear and rejoice. Glorify the Lord with me. I sought the Lord. He answered me and delivered me from all my fears. No need to be ashamed of that. It's like Psalm 23. He and me. He matters to me. I matter to him. So it is important for us to say that there is an individual experience that God gives, that he does care for us. As Paul would say, the Son of God loved me and gave himself for me. But it is interesting to see, I think, in Psalm 34, and if we had more time, we could look into this in more detail, and you may care to do that for yourself, that this psalm that begins with this very deep and personal experience of God's care for me, delivering me from all my fears, actually develops itself into something which is of enormous value to other people and to the community. Notice how the believer wants to share his or her joy with others in verse 2 and 3. My soul will boast, let the afflicted hear and rejoice. Now, my dear friend, if you're boasting about yourself, your friends will not hear and rejoice. Is there anything worse than the club bore? Is there any affliction worse than listening to someone who talks only autobiographically about themselves? But here you see is the Christian who is not talking so much about themselves, but about the great grace of God towards them. And when we have found that, when we found this pearl of great price, the joy of an experience of Christ, listen to this very carefully, it's important, is halved if we cannot share it with others. That's how God has made us. When we've read a wonderful new book, we want to tell other people. When we've visited a country on holiday, we love to tell others about it. When we've seen a television program that is good, we long to tell others. I saw that one last week on the, I don't know the difference between a raven and a snow goose, but there was one on birds, and I for some reason turned it on, not being really very much a bird man. And it was on these birds of paradise that have never been filmed before. Did you see that? It doesn't seem to me it's possible to see a program like that. Seeing photographs that have never been taken before without saying to somebody you meet, even if it's only the cleaner in the morning, did you see that program? Wasn't it amazing? These birds showing off to their mates, you know, in the most priceless way. Even the city dressed up in all its garments isn't as ridiculous as some of those birds. May it just be a joke. It may be a children's joke, but it's a funny one, and they love it, and they want to tell us, and we want to tell somebody else. Now, that telling surely is right. I got a letter only this week from Claire Finch. She wanted to tell us of the good things that God has done for her in South Africa in this gap year. And naturally, when I read it, I want to share it with other people. It's not just that we want to share it with the Lord's people and with those who are down so that they may rejoice with us, but we want to teach them about the God who can give us these things. Don't you love verse 11? Come, my children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. What a blessing to have a teacher who's got a testimony. Some of us can remember scripture taught by teachers who had no testimony and no knowledge of God. Here is a teacher who can speak from experience and say, what I'm telling you and teaching you is really true. What is so compelling, I think, in Psalm 34, is that private experience becomes public usefulness. It's not only that we pass on the joy that we've discovered, but we call upon people to live in accordance with it. Look at verses 12 to 14. And they are meditated on by Peter and were read to us in the lesson a little time ago. Verse 12 to 14. Whoever of you loves life and desires to see many days, keep your tongue from evil, your lips from speaking lies, turn from evil and do good, seek peace and pursue it. So you see, this is not a selfish experience. This is experience that has a moral element to it. Beware of fanatical experiences that have no moral, ethical, unselfish fruit. If the experience of the church is not seen in its life and its good deeds, then it is bogus experience. Here is experience then under pressure, and it is just worth one last look, and this is where I finish. It is just worth looking at 1 Peter again, because Peter seems to have meditated a great deal in this psalm. But when this was read to us a little while ago, and so clearly read to us, it's a beautiful picture, isn't it, of living the Christian life. And he quotes these verses from Psalm 34 and verse 10 and 11 and 12 of 1 Peter 3. But will you notice the heading in the NIV, suffering for doing good? Peter is writing to Christians under pressure in an unsympathetic age where many are trying to harm them. And what he says, in that situation, you will keep your tongue from evil. You will turn from evil and do good. You will not be overcome by evil, but you will overcome evil with good. And you will do this, verse 1 of Psalm 34, at all times and in all places. That's the proof of a serviceable Christian experience. Well, you say, that's not been my experience lately. I hope it has. I hope that for many of you in times of fear or grief or whatever it may have been in recent weeks or months, you found that the Lord is close. But if not, maybe you haven't been exercising your spiritual muscles. So let me urge you as I finish to notice the very active verbs in Psalm 34. Verse 4, I sought the Lord. Have you been seeking him? Verse 6, this poor man called. Do you feel you're rather a poor man at the moment in some way or another? Well, call upon the Lord. Verse 17, the righteous cry out. And the last verse, they take refuge. Those are lovely verbs, aren't they? And they were a reminder to me that Christian experience does not come to us passively. It doesn't fall out of heaven. It comes to us in times of great difficulty, when we've had to seek the Lord, call out for him, cry for him, and take refuge in him. And make but trial of his love. Experience will decide how blessed are they, and only they, who in his truth confide. May that be true for you. Let us pray.